Honorable members, my colleague, the chairperson, Comrade Eunice Karim, members of the Standing Committee Finance, and members of the Select Committee Finance, the Reserve Bank Governor, Deputy Governors, and the entire management of the Reserve Bank, officials from Parliament, I'm not sure whether there's Treasury here, media, you are all welcome. If you remember when we met in Tshwane last year, among other things was that from time to time the Reserve Bank will brief us on issues related to the monetary policy. So today we'll get a briefing by the Reserve Bank on the economic performance and outlook. So, Governor, I hope you are ready. So let me not take much of your time because other members here, I think, will be participating on the SONA debate. So we'll try to move with speed so that we give them time to go and prepare themselves. So the floor is yours, Governor Khanya.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. It's good to be here. We normally avoid making public speeches or presentations just before the budget, but we couldn't miss this opportunity. Because we have been crying for this engagement with Parliament, and we would like to thank you very much for taking the initiative to organize this presentation. And we are coming here at a very difficult time in the global economy, and we are having this coronavirus, and we do not, as the economic profession, we do not yet have a comprehension of the extent to which it would damage economic activity. There are varied estimates, but without a doubt there's going to be a significant slowdown in China. And with that slowdown in China, it is going to affect many of the countries that are trading with China, both developed and developing. We have prepared a presentation here which is taking a monetary policy angle in terms of the economic development. And I have with me the delegation from the SAP. The presentation will be done by Chris Lowald, who is the head of the Economic Research Department. We also have Deputy Governor Naidu, who is also the CEO of the Prudential Authority. Fundi Chasivana, who is Deputy Governor responsible for Financial Markets and International Relations. Pamela Mjandana is the Head of Macro Modeling and Forecasting. So whatever we place here and we say this is where the economy is going in terms of the forecast, you could always direct the difficult questions to her. And Soraya Pendi, who is the Head of our Communication. And at this stage, I would like to hand over to Chris Lowald. We had said that it should not take more than 30 minutes so that we can spend more time interacting with the committee rather than us just telling you what our take is. Chris.
Thank you. I'm going to focus on monetary policy, of course, and in the process of doing so, I'll provide a bit of perspective on the South African economy and where it is now. Just for an overview, some of the points that we want to make is that low inflation has created some space for rate cuts. You will have seen a rate cut in July of 2019 and January of 2020, and I'll talk a little bit about what the model is telling us about rate cuts going forward. Growth is weak, as we all know, primarily for structural reasons, but lower rates may help on the margin. Monetary policy credibility is very important and has helped to mitigate South Africa's long-standing stagflation problem, and I'll show you a little bit about what that looks like and why it matters. I'll talk a bit about elevated country risk because this is one of the main risks to upward pressure on inflation and on interest rates. And we'll make the point that getting to lower rates is really about achieving lower inflation rate with lower risk in the economy generally. The repo rate is down to 6.25%, as this graph shows you. Our model currently sees a second cut in late 2020. But you can see overall the nominal repo trajectory over many years.
Yes, if you agree. Firstly, using words like stagflation, repo rate, and so on.
Yeah.
A lot of us here are new. Could you also speak a bit slower and explain what that means? We don't have your technical expertise.
Sure.
And we're not apologetic about it. We are politicians. We're not elected because we are PhDs in economics. Please explain to me.
Sure. Well, as I'm going to show you a slide later in the presentation and talk through what stagflation means. It's the combination of low growth and low inflation coming together at the same time and how they link to each other. So we normally think in an economy about high growth generating high inflation. This is a situation, of low growth and high inflation. I misspoke. The repo rate, of course, is the main policy rate that the bank uses to set, and it is the interest rate on which all other interest rates in the economy are based. So when the repo rate moves, all the other market rates in the economy adjust alongside that nominal repo rate. So this is the repo, this is the rate that the bank focuses on when it makes its policy decisions. And as you can see from that graph, which goes back to 2007, in the run-up to the global financial crisis, right on the left-hand side of that graph, you will see that interest rates were raised quite aggressively to deal with a very strong inflation pressure that was coming through at that time. The exchange rate was depreciating a lot, and oil prices were going up very strongly. And as those two combinations translated into very strong food price pressure. Food price inflation. And then with the global financial crisis, you can see the inflation rate came down, and along with it, the nominal repo rate there. If I had the inflation rate on that graph, it would track along with that repo rate. And since that point, you've basically had a pretty flat nominal repo rate structure. It bottomed out in 2013, right in the middle of that graph. And then ticked up a bit up until 2016 as inflation ticked up. But I'll show you what the inflation rate looked like over that period just now. So here's the inflation forecast going forward. I mentioned that the repo rate ticked up between 2014 and 2016, and this graph shows you why. Just right in the middle of that picture, you can see that that red inflation rate is spiking well over 6% in those years, and the repo rate ticked up in response to that. And then after 2017, the inflation rate started to moderate quite a lot, partly from oil price shocks, partly from the exchange rate improving, and the inflation rate started to come down. There are a variety of things going on in the trajectory of the inflation forecast there, the inflation rate, so that red movement, the red line coming down into 2017. Some of the drivers of that are much lower food price inflation, oil prices were coming down, the exchange rate was a lot more stable, and so we had a range of exogenous factors that were driving down that inflation rate in that period up until about 2018. Since then, additional drivers of low inflation have come into play, like rental prices. Food prices have remained low, and in fact, the exchange rate has actually strengthened slightly on top of that. More recently, we've seen oil prices come down yet again. And all of those factors are helping to moderate that inflation rate right around that 4.5% midpoint of the target. You can see that on the right-hand side. So that middle dark line is the midpoint of the target band. And you can see the red line as it goes forward into the future, and the dotted part of it in particular is our inflation forecast, and you can see that that's moderating and staying very close to that 4.5% midpoint of the target range. So one of the other things that's going on here is that inflation expectations have come down. So I mentioned the exchange rate, I mentioned food prices, I mentioned oil prices. All of those have also helped to bring what South Africans think inflation will be in the future down. So we do a survey run by the Bureau of Economic Research, and that tells us what future inflation rates South Africans think are going to happen over various time frames, 1 year ahead, 2 years ahead, and so on. And those inflation expectations have tended to be very, very sticky around that 6% level, so at right at the top end of the inflation target band, and puts you in a position where you risk having to raise interest rates every time the inflation rate goes over 6%. Historically, we haven't, but that risk is always there. Now, with inflation expectations ticking down quite nicely towards that 4.5% midpoint, it gives more monetary policy flexibility. It means that you don't have to worry quite as much about inflation being pushed up over the 6% top of the target band as quickly as it might have in the past, and that's a very positive sign for monetary policy. I'll talk a bit more about that later. As a result of all this, inflation's on track for the longest ever period inside the target range. So this graph is showing you targeted headline CPI inflation going back to the year 2000 when inflation targeting was started. And you can see that we experienced a big pickup of inflation right in that 2002-2003 period associated with the Argentine crisis, the Russia crisis, and a lot of exchange rate depreciation. And then it came down very, very nicely around the midpoint of that target band in the period from running roughly from 2003 up to 2007. And that was a period of quite a lot of macroeconomic stability and very good economic growth. The inflation rate picks up again, that middle spike, and that's the global financial crisis, where again you had this combination of skyrocketing oil prices, rapid depreciation in the exchange rate, and very high food price inflation. And then since the crisis, we came down again. From 2011 to 2017, you can see that blue line, that inflation rate, bobbling again right around the top of that 6-point mark. And that's the point I made on the previous slide about a discomfort that we experienced with having that inflation rate at the top end and the risks that that entailed, that interest rates would have to be used more aggressively to move inflation lower and put the economic recovery at risk. So when that inflation rate starts to come down to the 4.5% mark, again, on the right-hand side of that graph from 2017, it adds quite a lot of comfort that policy is doing the right thing and that the inflation rate is much better behaved. Inflation for poor South Africans has also come out lower in recent years inside the target range. And I'm showing you two inflation measures here. One is headline inflation, so this is for the economy as a whole and all income groups. That's the gray line there. And then red, which is decile one, so this is poor South Africans. And you can see that the inflation rate, given the basket that decile one tends to consume, has tended to be much, much higher than the average inflation rate for the economy. So poor South Africans, on balance, are the ones suffering the most or paying the most for higher inflation. And much of this has to do with the composition of the consumption basket. In particular, things like food, oil, and its pass-through into transport prices is a big problem there. What we've seen since 2017, and now we're looking on the right-hand side of that graph, you can see that that decile one inflation rate, the red line, peaked at about 9.1% at the end of 2016 and has now come down very nicely again into the target range. And in fact, it went much below the bottom of the inflation target range. So when it goes below the average headline CPI rate, you are protecting the purchasing power of those households. The inflation that they are experiencing relative to their income is lower, and that should be a positive for the economy and for those households in particular. Nevertheless, South Africa's inflation rate remains quite high compared with our peers. And what I'm showing you here is South Africa's inflation. So that's the headline rate yet again, is the dotted line. And then we're comparing it to a median of emerging market and developing countries. And you can see that roughly in the 2000s to about 2011, we were quite similar. We all had roughly the same inflation rates. But since 2011, we've diverged a bit. And so our inflation rate has been higher than that of other emerging markets. And that includes that has various kinds of costs to the economy, one of them being that you're losing competitiveness over that period unless your exchange rate is depreciating quite a lot, which causes other kinds of economic costs to the economy. And so from a comparative perspective, it is quite good for any country's inflation rate to be tracking along with the inflation rates of other economies. As I said, it has something to do with competitiveness, but it also implies that those other economies would, on balance, be able to have more monetary policy space and lower interest rates. So why is our inflation rate comparably high? This graph shows you one way of looking at the problem. We have calculated a price level or a price index that is formed by primarily public sector determined prices, but this is different from what you would be normally used to, which is an administered price index, which I'm not showing you here. Now, the difference between that government CPI, which is the red line that we've calculated there, and an administered price index is that the administered price index is heavily influenced by the dollar price for oil as imported into South Africa. And so it creates lots of volatility in that series and skews the way in which you think how the government sector or the public sector is pricing and passing through inflation into the economy. So our measure here that I'm showing you, and it's not an official measure, it's one we just do for our own analytical purposes, is composed primarily by taxes on fuel, alcohol, beverage, and tobacco taxes, the SIN taxes, and direct taxes levied by government, plus some of the other normal components of the administered price index. So what we're left with is a much more stable price index that we think is telling us something useful about the role of the public sector in inflation generally. When you compare that red line to headline CPI, which is the gray, so that's the normal CPI measure that we think of when we talk about inflation, and the blue line, which is that headline minus the government or public sector CPI, you can see just how big that gap is. So in a sense, the private sector pricing, which is reflected in that blue line, is seeing much lower inflation, and the red line is driving up the overall inflation rate. It has in the past driven it up by much more. If you look back to 2015, so further to the left-hand side of that graph, you will see that tax increases at that time pushed up that public sector CPI much, much more strongly. It has certainly been better behaved in recent years. And in fact, between 2016 and 2018, it was on average pulling down that headline CPI. So right in the middle of that graph, you can see that the red inflation index is below the headline CPI and is contributing to a lower inflation rate in that period. South Africa's growth, when we extend when we look now to the growth outlook, we can see that growth in recent years has been weak and indeed far below long-run averages. Again, I'm putting back this graph quite some distance in time, back to 2000, so you can see the quite strong growth rates of that period from 2000 to 2007, jumping up well over 5%. And then you see the dramatic plunge in growth, which again is associated with the global financial crisis or a result of that, right in the middle of that graph in 2008, 2009, and 2010. And then you can see the economy bouncing back reasonably well in 2010 and 2011. Over this whole period, the average growth rate was 3.3%. We are currently sitting at an estimate for 2019 at 0.4%, and our growth rate ticks up for 2020. We'll come back to that point. But you can see since 2011, essentially, the growth rate has weakened quite steadily, although most of that growth rate decline, so the change in the growth rate itself, has come through from 2011 through to 2016. 2016 happens to be the year when the global economy bottomed out. So the global economy went on a post-global financial crisis cycle and then bottomed out in 2016 and picked up again. And you can see the big difference with us is that we didn't pick up as much as with the global economy. Now I'm showing you that again in this picture. What I'm showing you here is just how disconnected South Africa's growth experience has been from world growth. And the point, of course, is that this is quite unusual. We tend to grow very, very well correlated with global growth, as you can see by the way in which those red and blue lines stick together up until 2011. So blue is the global growth rate, world growth, and the red is the South Africa-specific growth rate. Apologies, the legend seems to have been cut off here. But you can see this point very clearly, how the global economy has continued to grow at about 3 to 3.5%, and the South African economy has diverged quite substantially, with the biggest change in that growth rate coming from 2011 through to about 2016, 2015. Confidence, of course, remains very subdued. Again, I'm showing you very long time frames of what consumer confidence and business confidence look like, going back to 1991. And you can see on the far right-hand side of each of those graphs, the level of confidence is at a pretty low level. These are not levels that are much below previous periods when it's been low. So if you look at that consumer confidence index on the left-hand graph, that negative 7 is above roughly where we were from 1999 to 2001. It's above where we were in 2014, 2015, but it is still certainly low and well below the zero mark, which gives us some indication of whether the economy is growing or not. And then business confidence has a similar kind of thing. You can see, again, since 2011, I'm not sure you can hear me now, it's all right. Since 2011, business confidence has deteriorated along with those growth outcomes that I showed you on the previous graph. Okay, so what's been happening with employment and unemployment? Obviously, the unemployment rate features strongly in the headlines and the papers, as it should. What's quite interesting is to unpack what's actually happened here, and that's what I'm trying to do in this graph. So the unemployment rate is on the left-hand side, and you can see it going up in the post-crisis period from about 25% unemployment rate to up to 29.1%. But the right-hand graphs show you two different things. So the middle graph shows employment, seasonally adjusted over time, in measured as millions of people. And you can see, since the global financial crisis, 2011, we've actually had a growth in the level of employment over time. It has flattened out a little bit in the last year or two, which would be commensurate with the lower growth rate or the very low growth rate we're seeing. But the unemployment rate is really a function of the employment rate and the labor force growth. And on the right-hand side, I'm showing you that graph shows you the millions of people who are part of the labor force over time, going back from 2008 to 2019. And the average growth rate per year of that labor force is 373,000, roughly, people per year entering the labor force. The employment growth rate, however, is about 160,000 in this post-financial crisis period. So the combination of slowly growing employment and rapidly growing labor force generates that strong uptick in unemployment that we have seen. Household incomes continue to grow. Now I've turned to the economic growth kind of view, and I'm going to unpack a little bit how to understand that weak growth that we've seen in recent years. So household, one measure of growth, of course, is what households are doing. This is a graph showing you household incomes growing. So this is disposable income growth. And you can see it has been pretty jumpy, pretty volatile, in this post-global financial crisis period, running from 2011. But generally speaking, has been positive. So households with employed members have seen their disposable incomes growing, albeit sluggishly, over this whole period. More recently, household credit growth has ticked up. But what you can see here is household credit extension coming off of the global financial crisis. Again, there's a rebound here. There was very high credit extension growth in the run-up to 2009-2010. I'm sure most of you will remember that. And then you saw household credit plummet with the global financial crisis. And then you saw this pick up again up until about 2013. At which point the slowing economy started to wear down on the appetite for credit, and you can see that credit extension is adjusting downwards over the middle part of that graph from about 2013 to about 2017. And then since then we've seen a reasonable tick up in household credit extension. It's become positive again. Obviously, a much more robust growth rate or stronger household disposable income, much stronger employment growth would generate much stronger demand for household credit extension than we've seen up to now. So what does household consumption look like as a percentage of GDP? Well, it stayed pretty high, and that's commensurate, again, with that household disposable income. But consumption is not a great way to get growth. What you really want to see is investments and exports and that kind of thing, and I'll show you those just now. So the fact that household consumption as a percentage of GDP has ticked up, despite employment growth not growing very, very strongly, is indicative of an economy that is not actually moving that fast, as I showed you in those earlier slides, that the growth rate's being sluggish. Investment has been a bit more resilient than we tend to think of it being. On the left-hand side, I'm showing you overall capital formation in the economy going back very, very far into the past, into 1960. Just to give you a sense of what the post-2000 and sort of 5-6 era looks like. So if you look at the right-hand side of the left-hand graph, so we're looking at the red line here. If you look at this period here, investment actually is relatively strong compared to other periods of the cycle in the economy. So this is the 1970s and 1980s. You could see a period of quite high investment. And then you can see the collapse in investment as a percentage of GDP, basically running from sort of 1980 through to about 2003, and then picking up very, very sharply through this whole period. Now, part of that pickup, of course, is what happened in the public sector. Jumped a few. And that's that light blue line in the right-hand graph. You can see that public sector's picked up. Sorry, looking at the wrong part. What you want to look at is here on the right, where the mouse is. That's the pickup in public sector investment spending associated with ESCOM, Transnet, the World Cup, and other things. And that helped to boost this overall investment rate quite high. At the same time, you saw a very strong growth in private sector investment, which is this darker blue line here. And what's happened since the global financial crisis is that investment has not continued to accelerate, but it's stayed at kind of a highish level. And that, generally speaking, is positive, but it should have been growing more than that to get a much stronger growth rate. Public sector investment has come off quite a bit, as you can see here, with this blue line starting to tick down This would be about 2017, 2016 onwards. If we look at another big component of the economy, exports and net exports and imports, we can see that imports have stayed quite high, and that's commensurate with that relatively high level of investment and also household consumption and government consumption spending. And I'm showing you that import pickup here on the very far right-hand side in the light blue. That is imports as a percentage of GDP running from 1987 up to 2019 here. This is the very strong period of growth in the 2000s, and this is what's happened in the post-global financial crisis era. Again, imports have stayed high as a percentage of GDP. And here on the left-hand bit with the dark blue line is your exports. And exports have actually come off. So exports have not done as well as would have been expected given global growth. So one reason why South Africa's growth rate has not kept pace with the global economy is that while many other economies expanded their exports in the wake of the global financial crisis, South Africa did not. The left-hand graph shows you the balance of net exports, so this is exports minus imports. And you can see that as this goes down, what it shows you is that net exports are not growing as rapidly as imports. So one of the problems we've had is on the export side. This is a bit more surprising if we reflect on the fact that the South African Commodity Price Index has also remained quite high. So this just shows you our index of commodity prices. It's not the terms of trade. But this is just our export commodities. And you can see, going back to 2015, and if we extended this back to, say, 2000, you would find that that level of commodity prices is very high indeed. And that means for every unit of exports of commodities, the return on it is actually very high. So what's going on with those exports? Well, one problem, and in the economy generally, one problem is that you can link quite easily weakness in export sectors to problems like electricity shortages. What we're just showing you here is how much electricity is used by each of these sectors as a percentage of total industry use. And the takeaway here is just very simply that mining and manufacturing, which are on the very right-hand side of that graph, are highly dependent on electricity use, and so shortages will, all else equal, hit them or bind on them or constrain them more than many other sectors in the economy. Unfortunately, that constraint is likely to keep growth low for the reasonable future. We're showing you here on the left-hand side the what's called the electricity availability factor. And 2019 was the lowest amount of electricity available at any point in time for use by the economy. So this is how much electricity is being produced relative to how much electricity the industry is supposed to be able to produce. And that's dropped to something like 67%. Which, as you can see from that left-hand graph, is really very, very low indeed by historical standards and is likely to stay low for a while. What does that do to growth forecasts, both ours and those of other analysts? You can see that on the right-hand side. Obviously, it keeps the GDP growth forecast more muted than anybody would like it to be. Potential growth, partly as a function of that electricity constraint, has also fallen. So potential growth is the growth rate that you would expect the economy to be able to achieve over time without generating very strong inflation or very large movements in things like unemployment or capital lack of capital use. And so what I'm showing you here is the output gap, which is a measure of what the economy has actually done in any particular year relative to potential. So the potential growth rate you can think of as being that solid line right in the middle. And the blue line is what the economy has done relative to that potential. And so what that blue line is telling you, falling below that zero dark line, is that the economy has basically underperformed its potential quite systematically in recent years. And again, this will be in line with those growth rates that I was showing you earlier. So the economy should be able to produce quite a lot more, but isn't, and that's what that output gap is telling you. I'll come back to the output gap shortly. Now, one of the things that monetary policy has been trying to do is to improve credibility. And this is the stagflation graph that I promised I'd come back to. And the point here is this, is that South Africa has historically suffered from stagflation. So in other words, the combination of high inflation and low growth is the norm. And that occurs essentially because of the way in which the economy works. For monetary policy to work effectively, you cannot be, or you don't want to be, in stagflation. So when the economy's growth rate is slowing, you don't want inflation to be rising. And I'm showing you in this graph two distinct periods when stagflation was very, very strong indeed. One runs back to 1972, 1973, and that's the left-hand side of that graph, where you can see a big divergence occurring between those blue and red lines. The blue is inflation, the red is GDP growth. And basically running up until approximately the mid-1990s, stagflation was actually the norm for South Africa. So higher inflation tended to generate a worsening economic growth performance. Between the mid-1990s and running up to about 2011, 2010, you had the reverse. You had a more normal relationship with lower inflation and stronger growth. And you can see that right in the middle there with those choppy lines in this period from the mid-1990s onwards. As the red growth rate is picking up, you can see that coinciding with the decline, the moderation in inflation. Now, one of the difficulties we've had in the most recent period is on the right-hand side, we also entered a phase of stagflation. It wasn't as big as, and it wasn't as severe as what happened in the mid-1990s period on the left-hand side of the graph, but it was still binding. And so you had growth rates declining with inflation ticking up. And one of the things, of course, we've tried to do is to talk inflation down to ease that binding constraint and to create space for monetary policy. So that trade-off between higher inflation and lower growth is better now than it used to be, and we should be able to get to lower inflation and lower rates. And in fact, over the past year, that is exactly what we've seen. So that lower inflation outcome that we've got has created space to generate some space for monetary interest rate cuts. This is just a review of our CPI inflation forecast and what we see going forward. So we see that inflation rate staying right at the middle of that target band, that's the blue line, and we're quite confident, 94% probability, that that inflation rate, barring any very large shocks coming our way, should stay very well behaved in that area, and all else equal would tend to keep interest rates down. Monetary policy doesn't have to react to it, and that is good for long-run planning and long-run growth. There are some lingering problems. One of them is the upward pressure that's being placed on long-term interest rates from rising country risk. And you can see in this post-2011 period how that risk measure, this is the Emerging Market Bond Index for South Africa, it's spread over global rates. Global risk has kept picking up very, very substantially in this post-2011 period. There was a spike in 2015, and unfortunately in the 2018-2019 period, right on the right-hand side of that graph, you can see that risk measure has picked up more aggressively again as well. Part of the story here is about the credit ratings agencies and their assessment of South Africa. generating a view in the markets that we are riskier than we were in the past, and that pushes this EMBI spread up and generates the possibility of more exchange rate and inflation risk in future. So far, it has not materialized. Part of the reason for that risk going up is that we happen to sit in a bunch of countries, with a bunch of countries that have reacted to the weak growth in the post-global financial crisis period by ramping up public debt. And you can see on the left-hand side, this is just a comparative view of South Africa relative to a whole bunch of other countries, running from the Philippines on the far right to Argentina on the far left. And you can see how our public debt in this this post-global financial crisis period has increased quite a lot as a percentage of GDP. We are in company with Argentina, Brazil. Some of these economies, like China, Chile, Colombia, who are also on the left-hand side, and Brazil also to some extent, these were economies that had very low debt levels generally, and so a large chunk of their growth performance in the post-global financial crisis period was generated by taking on more debt. So we did something similar, but we didn't get the growth throughput from that debt buildup that some of these other countries have seen, and that generates higher risk. South Africa also continues to run a fairly large current account deficit, so we continue to borrow from the rest of the world. Again, I'm showing you a comparative picture of that. This is the current account balance as a percentage of GDP just for the year 2019. And you can see how different kinds of countries behave. You can see on the United Arab Emirates and Russia and Saudi Arabia, well over to the right-hand side, they run quite large current account surpluses. So they are producing more than they consume, and they send out that profit, if you will, is invested in the rest of the world. Vietnam and China, also on the left-hand side, are not oil producers, but they are major exporters of all kinds of goods, as you know. On the far left is Colombia, and next to that is South Africa, Chile, Egypt. Our current account deficit is certainly much better behaved than it has at various points in the past, but it remains relatively large, and it, again, is perceived as a risk factor when looking at the economy generally. We are running a trade surplus, so our imports, although they remain at a fairly high level, have been squeezed a little bit on the margin, and our exports have done a little bit better recently, and that's generated, on balance, a bit of a trade surplus. But that trade surplus is outweighed by the payments we make on government debt, sovereign debt. And because non-residents hold lots of that sovereign debt, those interest payments flow out of the country, and they create a big chunk of that current account deficit I showed you earlier. So one component of the current account balance is the trade. The other component is the interest payments. And there are some other components as well. But the big mover here and the one that's generating the big deficit on the current account is these interest payments abroad. So how does the market view South Africa in recent times relative to other countries and given these risk factors that I've pointed to? Well, this is one measure of that. So South Africa remains investment grade. And Brazil is sub-investment grade. And what I'm showing you is how the spread, the cost of insuring sovereign debt against default compares to South Africa at investment grade and Brazil at sub-investment grade. And what you can see is that we are actually paying more. That dark line is well above the green line despite being remaining investment grade. So much of the market is acting as if we are at a sub-investment grade level, and we don't seem to be doing much about those risks, whereas Brazil has in recent times. And so while their risk measure is declining, ours is remaining quite elevated. Global conditions are generally helping South Africa. World interest rates are unusually low, and that is a big benefit to us. It means that all else equal, our interest rates on marketable debt is not as high as it would otherwise be. And so the global economy really ought to be seen as a support to us and giving us time to deal with our risk factors. All of what I've said of the recent slides, the trajectory of inflation, the risk factors feed into the way in which repo is thought about by the Monetary Policy Committee. This is just illustrative. This won't add up to anything in particular, but because there's more to the rate number and the movements of it that I'm showing you here. But I'm just giving you a sense of how these different factors I've talked about impact on where the repo is today. So weak cyclical growth on the left-hand side is clearly pulling down the repo rate, all else equal. Low foreign rates are doing the same thing. So that was the slide I just showed you, how low global rates are benefiting us. The fact that inflation is very close to that midpoint of the target, with the forecast showing inflation ticking up slightly in the outer years of the forecast, means all else equal that there's a little bit of upward pressure on the repo rate, but very small. But that high risk premium is the big driver here on the right-hand side. And so when you think about the repo rate settings, that risk premium, of course, plays some role in addressing the risk of exchange rate and inflation picking up in the future. So let me conclude. South Africa clearly has serious growth challenges, but these go quite far beyond monetary policy. I've used the electricity story to tell you one set of constraints that seem to bind on the economy. We've achieved lower inflation, and we've improved policy credibility, which has helped us deal with this trade-off between stagflation, so higher inflation and lower growth, and that creates a benefit for us because it creates monetary policy space to deal with the weak growth problem in the economy. It creates that space to cut interest rates on the margin. The higher SA risk premium creates upside pressure on the rates that is very hard to ignore. So if we can continue to get lower inflation and keep it well-behaved and de-risk the economy, that definitely creates more monetary policy space to lower rates. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Chair, I think that I would then take it back to you, and we could take a round of questions, and then we will deal with the questions.
Thanks to the government. Colleagues want to ask questions for clarity. Let me recognize you. Honorable Okam, Ryder, Dr. George, Nofi, Chuambu Nomtamumian. Wambo, Morolong, in that order. Okam, can you start?
Thank you, Mr. Ganyahu, the presenter. Thank you very much for the information that you gave to us this morning. I think each one of us should brace ourselves for the impact that we are heading for. This is like being on an aircraft and the captain say, brace yourselves, because we are heading for a crash. This will be a crash landing, and we must hope that there will be survivors. If you look at our economical growth, that is the middle point in which or around which everything should go. And we are not doing anything to create growth. If we create growth, we will have investments. If we will have investments, we will have growth in jobs, a lower inflation rate, as you have said out here. My problem with this is that the Reserve Bank is the protector of our financial stability. And you have shown to us today that there are quite a number of issues that is threatening, but we are not pointing them out. We are not saying what are the issues that are threatening to our economy. According to me, it is the fact that everybody knows exactly what the problem is. Everybody sees that the Kaiser doesn't have any clothes on, but nobody is willing to say that, apart from the opposition. The ANC sees this as, well, the Kaiser doesn't have clothes on, but we're not going to do anything about it. We know that stuff like expropriation of land without compensation is having a huge impact on growth, on the investment possibilities in our country. We know that to say that the Reserve Bank has to be nationalized will have a huge, and has got a huge impact on growth and on investment possibilities. I can carry on with that. My question is just, when are we going to get to a point where the protector, and I know you are not there to create policy, but where the protector of our stability when it comes to our finances are going to have the guts to tell the Kaiser that he is naked and to tell it as it is with regards to what the exact facts are that are threatening growth and investment possibilities? Thank you.
All right, then.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd also like to appreciate the presentation. I think it's extremely informative. Thank you very much. Gives us a lot of info. But also leaves me with a few questions, not too many. Slide 8 is one that I want to take a quick look at. It says that SA inflation is quite high compared with our peers, and you're comparing inflation with the other emerging markets. Again, then, on slide 11, you show South Africa versus world growth. What I'd like an indication of is perhaps South African inflation to our growth compared to inflation in other emerging markets compared to their growth. So perhaps a four-line graph would have been useful for me there. Just an indication, because you're saying that we're growing slower than world growth, but I think we're growing substantially slower than other emerging markets, and just to compare our inflations on that basis. The other one I wanted to look at way ahead, slide 26, I beg your pardon. Again, increase in public debt is very high relative to peers. You don't need to answer this one, but just something I note. We've moved to the left on this graph as our politics has moved to the left as well, but that was just an aside. I would have been quite interested to see debt to GDP comparison as well, on something like this, because slide 16 you show personal debt to GDP or consumption, but just from a national point of view, I would have been interested to see that. If you can give us an indication, are we way out of line with other countries in terms of our debt to GDP? I believe we are. And then of course the interesting one, slide 29, which kind of gives me a segue into the real points that I wanted to make today, is perhaps what the presentation is not saying as much as what it is. And I think that the downgrade that we're about to experience, I hope not, but I think realistically speaking, especially after the Sona speech, we're very likely to face a downgrade. I saw Moody's also change some ratings yesterday for us, which had some impact on Friday, following the Sona. So there are increasing concerns that we're going to experience a downgrade. The models that we've seen in terms of the inflation going forward don't seem to reflect the past lived experiences of other countries that have gone through a downgrade. So I'm glad we've got the modeling guru here. Perhaps, I don't know if it's directly to you, but in terms of your model where you showed that we are likely to stay within the inflation band, is the downgrade taken into account in terms of that model? Because historically, I think internationally, any other country that's gone through a downgrade has experienced much higher inflation, and if only for a period. But if you can give us an indication, is that taken into account in that model? And if so, why are we different? I think that's the key point. And then perhaps a question to the Reserve Bank based on your role of oversight. So what is going to be the impact of the downgrade on the capitalization of the banks? Are there any marginal balance sheets where a possible run could be sparked? I understand obviously Basel III is in place to try and mitigate against that. But as investment downgrades happen, people tend to take money out. Is that going to impact any of our bigger banks? what is the impact going to of that going to be on the banking industry, for one. Part two of that same question is the impact of the lower risk appetite of the bank, of the banks, based on the downgrade. Obviously, they'll be protecting their balance sheets. They'll have a lower risk appetite. What impact is that going to have on the average South African consumer who's finding it more difficult to get hold of credit in an area where they're already constrained financially? And then perhaps to pull all of that together and maybe answer that question in part, the role of the state bank. Do you, we had a state bank mentioned in the Sona last week. Is there really a need for a state bank? And perhaps you can give us some information around the role that they're likely to play and why the current banks can't play that role. We had the Mzansi accounts rolled out. We've got the post office bank or the post bank that, that kind of is underplayed. Perhaps you can give us some insight onto that. Thank you.
Let me understand. You want them to explain what the president has said, whether it will work or it will not work. Well, last time we said they should not venture into policy and political space. Well, what are you talking about? Before I pass and go to the next person. So I don't want to make life difficult for them. Make it very clear the state bank issue, its establishment, and what is your problem.
Absolutely, Chair. Sorry, and I don't mean to put them in a difficult situation at all. I'm merely asking why there's a gap in the current banking system and whether that bank that needs to be filled by a state bank if it's the right vehicle for it.
Dr. George?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Very interesting as usual. You mentioned China and the impact of the coronavirus. China, as we all know, is our biggest trading partner, and already I've had information from business that activity in parts of China has virtually stopped, and that businesses are already starting to feel the impact of this on their businesses. I don't think there is any reason to panic, but surely we can already start factoring in the fallout from China. It's definitely not business as usual, and we should look at how we can mitigate the impact on our very fragile economy. Then our growth rate won't improve until we have fundamental change. That's very clear. We can't keep going on the same way because it isn't working. We need fundamental change to our economic policy. I know that you stick to your Band-Aid, Governor. We've had a discussion on that before. I want to know how certain you are that we can protect the value of our currency as our economic performance continues to deteriorate. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Abrams. Or let me find out. FF, do you have any questions? Okay. Honourable Noxie.
Okay, sir. Thanks so much. Let me join the Honourable Members and appreciate the presentation profusely. It's quite empowering as well. My first take, Chair, in terms of clarity, is on page 13. I see that the way it's done there, it's you have divided your employed from the labor force. And there's quite a difference as well in terms of the growth in both areas. Now, my question is whether you're talking about, when you talk labor force, you're also including the unemployed who are also probably unionized. Fundamentally, my question is, why do we have a difference between the employed and labor force, which is a bit for me. The second one, Chair, for me is whether there is a way that the Reserve Bank can know when some of the rich and wealthy of the country are hiding some taxable income that could have boosted the economy of the country. And there's a statement that you're making, Chris, in terms of how our economy should be able to produce more, but it is not. And you could have referred to this in terms of what you have presented. But my question is why? I didn't get that. Why is that? Chair, there is an issue that has happened with success in some of the Asian countries that has been referred to in the presentation. The issue of fighting corruption across the board, because there's a tendency of thinking that people who are corrupt are only those that are in power. And yet, clandestinely, when an opportunity is created, everybody grabs. And I'm asking a question as to whether the economy cannot be saved by a stern and firm fight on corruption. Thanks, Chair. I thought I had this last question, but I think I will save it for later.
Thanks. Honorable Shubham, then Murolo.
No, thanks, Chair. The one is that there is no scientific basis that expropriation of land without compensation will limit economic growth. It's actually a foolish observation to make such. Like, in the case of South Africa, for instance, majority of real investments, industrial investments, happen on state-owned land. Because all these special economic zones is state-owned land, like in Kuha, in East London, in Dube Trade Port, in Atlantis, and all the special economic zones and IDZs are state-owned land, and that is where bigger economic activity happens. So for anyone to suggest that a necessary and long overdue discourse about expropriation of land without compensation limits growth, it's not scientific. It's a very shallow argument. And of course it is inspired by the national question that defines South Africa, of those that are in ownership of the land now wanting to retain the status quo. So every opportunity they get to unscientifically speak against it, they just smuggle a nonsensical perspective. That's one. Two, there is no scientific basis that removing private shareholders from the central bank will lead to no growth. No such a thing. More than 90% of central banks in the world do not have private shareholders. And these are central banks that oversee far much more sophisticated and complex economies, far much bigger economies that have witnessed growth over the years with no private shareholders of their central banks. To now come and suggest that a discussion that private shareholders must be removed from the Reserve Bank will limit growth, it's nonsensical. It's not scientific. That is what we have to deal with. Like, some of these things are just basic logic in terms of what we are dealing with here. But I know that the Reserve Bank is mostly dominated by neoliberal direction in terms of what you think should happen. But I want to hear your perspectives, because you say that the growth challenges that are confronting South Africa are bigger than monetary policy. So what are the major contributors to the challenges that are facing economic growth? Your conclusion is this is bigger than monetary policy. So it's bigger than you, because your primary responsibility is monetary policy. What are the aspects that, and of course we're not calling you to articulate the policy. Let's just broaden the discourse. We will make our own observations, I'm sure, today and tomorrow when we debate SONA, in terms of what we think is at the center of no growth in South Africa. But what are your own observations? And then a nuanced question in terms of African Bank. It's what is the basis of the disposal now? Like, I know we've previously said that You can't be both a regulator and owner of the bank. And then the consortium of other banks as well. I'm sure that there's competition law issues that relate to their participation in African Bank. And maybe it was necessary when you were risking African Bank from the crisis at that time. But what are the terms and conditions of the disposal now? Shouldn't the African Bank be the nucleus of the envisaged state-owned bank? Because there is now an agreement, a national treasury, and I heard that even the president of the ANC, when he was giving the SONA a submission, said that the process of establishing a state bank should happen. Because, like, of all the banks that are in a public space now, the only viable one to become a nucleus for the state-owned bank is the African Bank, because the post office doesn't have a banking license, and it is still part of SAPO, which has got a lot of challenges in terms of what happens. So shouldn't we logically convert the African Bank into the envisaged state-owned bank that will then deal with all these things in a much more different way? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Mrolo. Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we are all worried that the debt to GDP ratio is spiraling out of control. We would want to find out from the Reserve Bank as to what do they think are acceptable, or what do you think is acceptable levels of GDP to ratio and manageable GDP to ratio. We are of course worried about the impact of coronavirus on exports and imports, given the fact that, as it has been mentioned, China is the largest trading partner of South Africa. I would really want you to expound on the possible impact of this virus on exports and imports. I see that the South African Reserve Bank is suggesting that investment has become more resilient. I would want to know why is this narrative not finding expression in the public media space. Are we suggesting that given the fact that South Africa is experiencing electricity shortages, that should these shortages occur in the next 12 to 18 months, there will be material impact on growth? Well, given the outcome of the Data Commission and the fact that data is a component of household expenditure, do you think that lower data will have impact on the inflation? Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Governor can respond.
Thank you. What I normally do is I take all the questions in the first round and ask the other questions that follow to go to my colleagues. But this is quite a plateful, so I will have to divide it amongst my colleagues, and just so that they can prepare themselves. Please, investment resilience and the impact of electricity shortage, impact of data costs on inflation, and the impact of COVID-19, bearing in mind that we do not know much about it at this stage. Naidu, if you could talk about African Bank and Post Bank and State Bank, and also if you could talk about the impact of the downgrade on the banking sector. I'm sure you can go into the stress test that we did on the on the banks.
DG Tachazivana. I'm sure they're quite a bit for you here. I will pick it up. Let me deal with the things, and then I will skip certain things and hand them over to you later. But the question, next set of questions about growth and investment, which I would like to deal with, which says that higher growth will lead to higher investment, and that leads to higher growth. No. It's higher investment that leads to higher growth. And because you have got higher growth, then you could have jobs. Jobs are an outcome of growth, and growth itself is an outcome of investment. Investment in physical infrastructure, physical assets, capital investment, and an investment in people. And then, of course, there is the key driver that comes, which is called technological progress. And so a combination of technology, people, and capital stock is what gives you growth. And from the growth, that is where you would get the jobs. So absent an investment in people and an investment in technology and an investment in capital stock, you are not going to have growth. And of course, all of these need an environment that is conducive for the investment. As we have seen from this graph that is currently with us, there was a time when public sector investment was fairly strong. It had slowed down, and quite frankly, given where the state of the fiscus is, public sector investment is not going to be a key driver of investment. The interesting thing about this slide is that the driver, the key driver of investment in this economy is actually the private sector. And the investment of the private sector is impacted by the environment and is impacted by sentiment. And as we had seen earlier on when we showed what is happening to private sector, to business confidence and to consumer confidence, if you sort out confidence through environment, 90% of your job is actually done. Former Secretary of the Treasury of the U.S. used to say that sorting out sentiment is the cheapest form of stimulus, because you almost pay nothing for it. All that you have to do is to create the environment and get the confidence going. Now, there was a question of what do we see as threats to the South African economy. Let me put it this way. What we tend to talk about at central banks is where are we vulnerable, rather than where the threats are coming from. Because a threat would suggest that somebody is sitting somewhere and say, how do I undermine the South African economy? Whereas the vulnerabilities come as a result of the state that you are in. There is no doubt that we had been firstly externally vulnerable. And what had made us externally vulnerable had been that we have been living beyond our means. So we are running what are called the twin deficits. We are spending more than what we are able to generate in the form of taxes. And that means that we end up with a fiscal deficit. And the fiscal deficit must be funded. And it is funded through raising debt. And as you raise debt, you are piling up on this, and you are then going to have to service that debt. In the servicing of that debt, as we had seen earlier, South Africa actually still has a shortage of savings. What do I mean when I say we have got a shortage of savings? The savings we generate in this economy does not even cover the little investment that we have, that is around 18% of GDP. The difference between what we save and what we invest in is what leads to the current account deficit, which means that we end up having to borrow from the foreigners. That borrowing from the foreigners have to be serviced, and you saw it. When you look at the composition of our current account deficit, if you look just purely at the trade balance, that is what we export and what we import, we are running a trade surplus. However,
If you look at the current account deficit slide on the right, you will see the yellow, the orange bars there, that the biggest driver is government debt service cost. So if you have to sort that problem, you are going to have to cut the interest bill of government, and cutting the interest bill of the government necessarily means that you have got to reduce government borrowing. Otherwise, you are going to continue to have that leakage. And yes, you can see from 2010, in 2010, we were paying 0.4% of GDP to the foreigners. By 2018, we were paying 1.5% of GDP to the foreigners. So that tells you then that we are vulnerable. Why? Because that current account deficit is financed by foreign borrowing. And the vulnerability that we worry about is, what if there is a sudden stop in capital flow? Or alternatively, what if we are downgraded and we fall out of the key government bond indices and foreigners start to dump South African assets? If that happens, the foreigners are going to demand to be compensated for it, which means that government is going to pay higher on its borrowing. And government is the most credit-worthy borrower in this economy. If government pays more, all of us are going to pay more. And if all of us are going to pay more, there is less available from all of us to spend, which means that economic activity is going to slow down. So that's what it means, taken to its logical conclusion. Of course, in the price, the paying of the price is not just going to be through just interest payment. These foreigners calculate their returns in foreign currency, which means that they want to be compensated. And that compensation would mean that they would want to buy the rent cheaper, which could mean that the rent would depreciate. And if the rent depreciates, what that could do is that it could feed through into domestic price formation. Inflation will go up. And if inflation goes up, the Reserve Bank is duty-bound to protect the value of the currency, and we will then respond to those second-round effects from the downgrade in order to make sure that we actually contain the inflation. So that is what it comes to. Who's going to tell Kaiser? We don't speak to Kaiser about this thing. There was stuff about our inflation compared to the other economies. Jita Sivana, that's where you are going to come in. Growth and inflation compared to other countries, that's where you come in. And debt to GDP compared to other countries, what is acceptable? You spend a lot of time analyzing other countries and telling them what not to do. It's your turn now to tell South Africans what we should not be doing. And Naidu, let's go to you, and then we'll ask Chris to deal with the questions that I'd asked to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me deal with African Bank in the first instance. We have expressed our view that we would like to exit our 50% shareholding. I think that the reasons why we want to exit is exactly as you've stated, Mr. Shivambu, that there is an inherent contradiction between regulating the bank and owning the bank. It is often the case that governments or central banks end up owning banks after they put into resolution. It's not a uniquely South African phenomenon, but it's something that we would like to exit as soon as possible. If government would like to buy African Bank and use it as a genesis of a state bank, I think government is more than willing to put in a bid. We certainly won't. So we won't block that. We will, at the end of the day, as a regulator, we will have to license a new entity. And so within the Reserve Bank, we've put in place, for want of a better term, Chinese walls between the shareholding responsibility, which a different deputy governor deals with, and the regulatory responsibility of African Bank. So I look after the regulatory responsibility of African Bank, and we would have to license any new bank or any new owner. But anybody is free to buy it, and we would have to adjudicate that on the basis of fitness and propriety. So if government wants to put in a bid, if government thinks that they want to use that as a genesis for a state bank, government is free to do that. From a shareholding perspective, we would have no objective. From a regulatory perspective, we would have to adjudicate that in terms of the Banks Act. The impact of a downgrade on the banks, let me say that the impact of a downgrade on the banks we think will be negative. How negative, it's not clear. But about 11% of bank balance sheets now are filled with government bonds. So banks own large shares of government bonds. In part, they're forced to hold that for regulatory reasons. Something called the liquidity coverage ratio forces them to hold what's called high-quality liquid assets. And high-quality liquid assets are mainly government and state and enterprise bonds. A downgrade might result in an increase in the bond yield and a reduction in the price, and that may have negative implications on their balance sheets. We have conducted two stress tests in the last 3 years, the first looking at the capital impact of a very negative economic scenario, including a downgrade, and the second looking at the liquidity impact of that very negative scenario. Under both of those scenarios, South African banks would be resilient and would be able to continue operating, would continue to have the necessary capital to meet the minimum capital requirements. However, it is obvious that if we are downgraded and if bond yields move, it would raise the costs of borrowing for banks, and that would probably be passed on to consumers either through less borrowing to consumers or through higher borrowing costs. So there would certainly be some negative impact. It's hard to quantify it precisely, but we are confident that the banks would be resilient to any significant change in borrowing costs, and we have modeled that. Chair, just a bit on illicit financial flows and the role that we play in preventing people from taking money out of the country or hiding money. Chair, I think that we are in a new era compared to the much of the last 10 years. We play a role in preventing illicit financial flows through our enforcement of exchange controls, but we play a cooperative role with the Financial Intelligence Center, with SARS, with the Hawks, and the NPA. And only when we all act together in cooperation with all of those agencies can we prevent illicit financial flows. Our cooperation is much better today than it was 3 or 4 years ago. It is still not perfect, but it is much better today than it was in years gone by. We think we make a difference in preventing illicit financial flows, but this is not a foolproof system. We know that people can still take money out of the country illegally and bypass our laws, both tax laws and exchange control laws. On a little bit on the reasons why we've got weak growth. And I don't think that there's anything that we would add that's new to the narrative. There are sort of what I would call South Africa's long-run reasons why we've got weak growth, and two of those biggest legacies relate back to apartheid: the quality of the skills of our workforce, the spatial dynamics of our country and our cities. Poor people live far from places of work. The concentrated oligopolistic nature of many sectors of the economy, all of those are long-run contributors to weak growth and to low levels of productivity. But, Chair, in the shorter term, there are also issues such as the low savings rate that the governor spoke about. We're far from international markets. We've got poor infrastructure, particularly on the African continent. And we have, at the moment, a binding constraint in the form of an energy constraint that would limit the amount and nature of growth. Those competitiveness issues can be unpacked into skills constraints. It is estimated that there are about 500,000 high-skilled vacancies in the South African economy, and with a multiplier of somewhere between 2 and 4, for every high-skilled person you employ, you create between 2 and 4 low-skilled jobs. If you were to import 500,000 skilled workers, you'll create between 1 and 2 million low-skilled jobs, literally overnight. the spatial dynamics of South African cities continue to prevent inclusive growth, with many poor people trapped in townships and rural areas, and so the need for efficient public transport is critical. From a competitiveness point of view, there are some tax rates in South Africa that are probably on the high side relative to our competitors. And because of various factors I think Chris outlined, our long-term borrowing costs for South African companies and corporates are high, and that certainly reduces our competitiveness. And then issues around policy certainty or uncertainty that may prevent or encourage investment. There's still certainly still some sectors where these issues bedevil investment. Thanks, Chair.
Chris, I would also want you to deal with those aspects that what we think drives growth. I see that your 2008 paper has recently been cited, so I suppose that means it is still valid. So if you could draw from that. Just one thing on African Bank that I needed to just highlight. The agreement, the shareholder, or the resolution agreement between the Reserve Bank and the bank include a clause called take along and come along, which means that no shareholder can sell on their own. So if the Reserve Bank has to sell 10% of what it has, the others are also entitled to sell in similar proportion to the Reserve. So it's a complex thing. It's not just that the Reserve Bank can just say, I'm getting rid of my share. The other shareholders would also have to be reduced proportionately. So those are the things that we would have to deal with. I must just state that what we had gone out, because you're looking for the terms and conditions, what we have gone out with is not for calling for bids for the sale of African Bank. We have called for bids for a transaction advisor on the appropriate way of executing the disposal of the stakes in African Bank. So we are at this stage, we are still just looking for a transaction advisor, and we are at one with the Treasury in terms of the approach that we have taken to say, let's go look for a transaction advisor, let us look for the different options, and based on those different options, then we can take an appropriate step. Chris?
Thanks. So let me clean up a few questions also. On the labor force and the employed, of course, the labor force plus the unemployed, sorry, the employed plus the unemployed equals the labor force. So the unemployed is the gap between that fast-growing labor force line and that slower-growing employment line. I just didn't show the numbers of unemployed in there, but you would have seen that more clearly if I had done so. On the coronavirus question, look, I think the upshot is that we don't know yet. The historical experience with SARS, which was a more fatal virus at this stage, but did not spread as much, was that China suffered a very strong decline in quarter-on-quarter growth. But then that rebounded very quickly because the disease did not spread very widely. The problem with coronavirus is that it's spreading very, very rapidly. So even though the fatality rate is lower, it's very hard to predict how much further that will extend, and therefore it's extremely hard to come up with a clear view about the economic impact. Certainly, from a forecasting point of view, we will start in our next MPC forecast round for March to mark down global growth rates, but I can't tell you at this stage how much. We are trying to do some work on this, and we'll try to, maybe in the March meeting, we will try to put a specific figure on this for our own growth rates. It is useful to think a little bit about what coronavirus has done so far, and the way in which we would think about the economy adjusting to it or reacting to it. So one of the things we've seen clearly is that the oil prices have fallen very, very sharply, and gold prices have gone up a bit with more global uncertainty. With commodity prices staying relatively high, it's actually been a short-term benefit to our terms of trade. So from a pure price effect, The direction we've seen so far is actually positive for South Africa. Now, I wouldn't get too excited about that because, of course, as the Chinese economy slows, volumes of commodities demanded will eventually slow, and those prices will fall also. So the long-term impacts could be quite negative, or could be very negative. Now, from a macroeconomic point of view, how do you kind of mitigate the impact of this? There are some features of the South African economy which help with that. So one of them has been this terms of trade effect in the short term, but the other mitigating factor will be when the exchange rate depreciates in response to a hypothetical slowdown in growth or decline in the terms of trade. And what that does is it helps the economy to rebalance. It shrinks import consumption, and all else equal, it should help with your export sector. But that will only go so far, and so you'd have to think about other mitigating factors as you saw sort of the magnitudes of the economic slowdown. Inflation remaining low, I think, is an important component to that. So if the exchange rate depreciates, you have low pass-through into domestic inflation, and so it creates some space, again, for interest rates to respond if they need to. And I think that's quite an important point, actually. On the electricity shortages on GDP, this is very hard to model. The way we tend to think about it is, to what extent did load shedding in a particular quarter feed through into what we saw as a realized lower growth rate than we were expecting for that particular quarter or year? And the other channel through which it operates is through potential growth. So at one point I spoke about the potential growth rate coming down from about 2.5%, 3% to something like 1%. And so the electricity shortages and the binding constraint that we think that has on the economy filters through into the way in which you think about long-term growth. Obviously, in the shorter term, we try to unpack how load shedding and that electricity availability factor impacts on confidence in the economy and what businesses and firms actually do on a quarter-to-quarter basis. But again, it's a moving target. Let me say something about downgrade modeled. The answer to that is no. So we do not explicitly include downgrade in the forecast. But one of the slides I showed you was that South Africa's risk factor was higher and long-term interest rates are higher because of fiscal and other risks to the economy. What that enables you to do is to think about, well, how the markets price this in and how does it impact on particular variables in the market pricing in the economy. And so to that extent, it is factored in. So we don't factor in more than that. We don't say, well, Moody's downgrade will have an additional impact and then put it in. Now, one caveat to that, of course, is that we do model this for our own considerations as part of the MPC. And so we provide scenarios to the Monetary Policy Committee estimating what we think those kinds of impacts would be. So it's not that we're not seeing analysis on it. It's just not part of our baseline forecast that we publish. One of the things to keep in mind, again, about the exchange rate impact following a downgrade is that exchange rate depreciation has two effects. It may increase consumer prices, but it also tends to lower in the short-term GDP growth. So the net effect is what we would be concerned about, and it's quite hard to estimate that up front and get a clear picture of what's going to happen in the future on that one. Just on getting to stronger growth, I guess the thing about this is just thinking about the kind of comparative literature on this, and a lot has been done. I would certainly refer you to the Spence Commission work on growth, and one of the kind of high-level takeaways they put out in that work, the Spence Commission 10 years ago or so looked at countries that grew I'm trying to remember the exact details, by more than sort of 10% a year for 27% for 25 years? right, or 15 years, something like that. And the conclusions they drew were that economies, particularly small economies like South Africa's, really ought to be as focused as they can on using global knowledge to boost investment and to use that in turn to be open to global markets. Because if you think about it, you're a small economy, you can only sell so much to your own citizenry, but you have a huge global economy that you can sell into. So even capturing a small part of that global market share can generate very large growth benefits for a relatively small economy like South Africa. Now, what really matters, of course, in investment and exports is the way in which that generates technological progress and productivity growth, what we call total factor productivity, and how that translates into disposable income for households. So at some point I showed you a graph that showed disposable income bouncing around quite a lot. If we were growing very rapidly, that disposable income line would be growing very, very aggressively on the back of productivity gains, which are in turn on the back of exports, investment, and in a sense the importation of knowledge from the rest of the world. Why don't I leave it at that? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just to respond to the question on comparing South Africa to other emerging market countries. So on average, emerging market countries are expected to grow at about 4.5% between 2020 and 2021. And in sub-Saharan Africa, that number is expected to be around 3.5%. We are projecting growth of between 1.2 and 1.9 over the same period of time. So our growth is lower than the emerging market average and also lower than the sub-Saharan African average. And with regards to inflation, inflation in emerging market countries is between 2 and 4% at the moment, so it ranges, and we showed you our slides that highlight that we project that headline CPI inflation will reach around 4.5% in 2022. So there is a difference in terms of our growth rate and also our inflation compared to other emerging market countries. With regards to debt to GDP, I would say that the key issue is around whether the level of debt is sustainable given the revenue generation of the country and the growth level of the country. So there is no magic number around debt to GDP. But there are a few principles that are quite important. And one would be that when one borrows, generally borrowing for consumption is not recommended because you'll never be able to pay off that debt. So borrowing for revenue-generating activity and borrowing for investment that will boost long-term productivity is quite important. South Africa itself, though, has set a target around a comfortable level of debt to GDP of around 60% of GDP, and that is a SADC target of debt to GDP. And one would find that if, say, you are the United States and you have a reserve currency, so you have a currency that other countries hold as their reserve, you can get away with more because as much as you have a high debt to GDP, it can go as high as 200% of GDP in other countries. But if you have the growth and you have the mechanisms to continue to generate growth, you can get away with a lot more things. So South Africa is not a reserve currency country, so we don't have that luxury. But the Treasury has set and has signed on to the SADC Convention in this regard. With regards to financial stability, so yes, the SARB has a dual mandate, but when we came through today, we came to talk more about price stability and to talk about the developments in monetary policy. But we certainly have been doing work on financial stability risks. And in this regard, in our November publication of the Financial Stability Review, we have published a risk assessment matrix that highlights a number of areas that are quite worrying for us with regard to financial stability risks. Weak growth is one. The deteriorating debt matrices of government are the other, and the fragility of state-owned enterprises are amongst that list of factors that are concerns for us as a SARB with regard to financial stability. So I think I should leave it there on the response to financial stability. And there was a question around fighting corruption. So can fighting corruption assist in generating growth? So the main question with regard to corruption is whether it does become macro-critical at what point. And one would ask whether the funds that government is spending are contributing towards investment and to boosting consumption in the economy. So how much growth does the 1 rand that government spends generate in the economy? And when one looks at what we call the fiscal multipliers, which is how much growth does this 1 rand that government spend contribute to the overall growth, we have found that the numbers are low and sometimes go on being negative as well. And that means that we're paying for inefficiency to some extent. So one would see that there is an increase in the level of government spending, but that is not translating to additional investment in the economy. It's not translating to additional growth because you're paying for inefficiency. So that is like a leakage in the system. So the income is not circulating in the economy as it is. It's getting drained out. So that is one way in which one can think about it. So to that extent, if one can reduce the level of inefficiency and reduce the level of leakage, and if funds were to go to where they intended, one could start to see a positive impact on growth.
That deals with the question. The DG here said that when she talked about financial stability, says we have a dual mandate. Just to say that dual is normally used when the two mandates rank equally. In our case, they don't rank equally. The Constitution says our primary mandate is price stability, and it then goes on and says we shall do such other things as are ordinarily done by other central banks, and such things must be spelled out in a national legislation. The Financial Sector Regulations Act spells out the responsibility of the Reserve Bank with respect to financial stability. It doesn't rank at the same level as our primary mandate. That's the debt to GDP that she mentioned at the SADC convention, to say that the thing has gone further. In the context of the discussion on African integration, we found that there is macroeconomic convergence in Southern Africa. There is a different set of indicators in East Africa. There is a different set of indicators in Central Africa and in West Africa. And in the Association of African Central Banks, we then decided that we must go through and align the indicators and recommended them to the technical committee of experts of the African Union. So those thresholds of around 60% are now going to become continental macroeconomic convergence criteria. And they become important because you can't talk of Africa one day having a single currency with different macroeconomic policies. You can't have one currency that has got different inflation rates. So we are going to have to converge in that. And that is a long journey. We have been very clear of that, but it is also important because it's going to underpin the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, and central banks are thus facilitating that Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement through integrating the payment system so that African exporters and importers can trade freely with each other and be able to settle their debt across the continent with speed. So that's so I think that we have dealt with all the questions, Chair.
Okay. Thanks, Governor, and your colleagues. Are there follow-up questions before I hand over to Honorable Karim, then we'll change? It looks like there are no follow-up questions. Let me make two comments and hand over to my colleague here. I think when we talk about this economic growth, we must talk about inclusivity. It should not be the economic growth on the expense of the previously marginalized, who are the majority. It's very important. Because we can't have an economy that has got so many people who are not participating, because 70% almost of the wealth of South Africa is in private hands. And those are the previously advantaged. And that, we can't be happy with the status quo. And amongst other things, the transformation of the financial sector is very important. And we are going to push for it as these committees. Because we believe that's our responsibility. It can't be good enough that our people should be consumers and only be clients of banks, but they can't be part of the ownership of those banks. It can't be. Because that economy will remain exclusive. So we have a mandate ourselves to make sure that our people should be part of the mainstream economy. The issue of job creation is becoming a serious problem. Yesterday I was reading one of the daily papers. I saw young graduates protesting, I think it was in East London somewhere, I saw a photo. It's reaching a high proportion, and once we have got so many young people outside the job market, now including the graduates, it's going to cause political and social instability. I understand that you say here the problem is much bigger than monetary policy. Probably, is it next week that the minister is tabling the budget? Maybe the minister will have to deal with issues that are bigger than the monetary policy. Real issues that are facing young people, not the theories of economies. Young people are adversely affected by this economy. They are not the beneficiaries. Let alone women who have been suffering triple oppression. So these are some of the key issues that are affecting our people. Not talking big English and semantics about the economy and so on, but how does this economy relate to a person who stays in Malamulele and Garankuwa, who has been outside that economy? It's then that we'll be talking. But if every time we talk economy, we are threatened by investors, that can't be the type of economy that we are talking about. The moment you say you want to do this, what about the investors? What about the South Africans? We have got the needs. You only are interested in the concerns. You are not interested on the needs of the citizens. Once you start to do that, you are going to have serious problems. Really. So it's very important that we strike a balance between the needs of the South Africans who are outside the economy and the concerns that investors are raising. So that balance becomes very important. But if every time we talk the economy, we have to transform the economy. No. There will be a low investment rate. Investors are concerned. We have done so many things to deregulate the economy, but these investors are not coming. Instead, we see so many people losing jobs. Standard Bank has closed branches all over. People are losing jobs. Last week I saw the brewery, SAB, what is that new company that bought SAB? they are retrenching. I don't see any new job opportunities. Instead, I see more people being retrenched. And even SOEs are threatening to retrench people. Yesterday, I saw Eskom, seemingly they want to close three, power production plants, some in Mpumalanga, and they are going to retrench people. So we are in a very serious problem. We must talk real issues that affect South Africans who are not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. We're blaming the private sector, but now if our own SOEs, what were they established for? If now they are becoming problematic to an extent of retrenching people, we must discuss these issues and find solutions. So thanks very much. I'll hand over to the chairperson, Comrade Karim.
Yeah, Chris, much to say, except that I thought part of the question on corruption was something that does fall within your domain, together with other entities, which is illicit financial flows. Comrade Chair, I know your committee meets four times a year or twice a year with all the other SARS, police, NPA, and so on. But what might be helpful, something we can discuss offline, but the committee can consider, is that even when you come and give your quarterly economic outlook report, there should be a next section on what you're doing as the South African Reserve Bank to reduce illicit financial flows in cooperation with other entities that are relevant. Comrade Chair, we have raised repeatedly the need for an interministerial task team on this matter. The committee has passed report after report adopting this resolution. I think, with due respect, the Standing Committee on Finance should raise this thing with the minister. We should raise next week with the minister as well. Obviously, interministerial committees are stepped by the president. Parliament cannot prescribe. Our words are chosen appropriately. Frank Jenkins, you remember, that, you know, we would ask the executive to consider because we can't prescribe. But we have to do a lot more on illicit financial flows. You most certainly have a role to play in cooperation with others. It's too big an issue. It's bigger than ever before. From all accounts we read, even from experts' comments, it's increasing. On the other hand, we all know how acutely stressed the revenue services are. So more than ever, Comrade Chair, I would suggest we put this issue on the agenda every time. Because when the Reserve Bank comes, of course the governor can't always come. But, you know, it's important on the governance here. I know it's preoccupying you, but we need more action, more decisive action, and we need some people in the criminal justice system, as you keep saying. Then there are other issues which I don't think we can discuss yet, not strictly speaking, yeah. But there are people sitting there in Dubai as well, you know. How does the money get there and nobody is able to stop it? Then the other thing we keep raising with you is it's not enough for the Reserve Bank to refer matters to the police. We don't know what they are. They're confidential by nature. We work with other entities. But it's the task of you and the other to follow up with the police. What have you done? We can't do that. So we know the police are challenged, NPA is challenged, but, you know, Comrade Chair, we need to know more about what is being done. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.